appears that we're ready to begin our broadcast day here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Yeah, oh, there we go. Desperately seeking volume. Very bad day for me to arrive in the studio late. I break through the door here. I enter the studio and I find the mic situation in disarray. He asked me to talk about this at the meeting, but I failed to understand we were talking about the main channel one here. So I spend, good God, 18 minutes trying to figure out which mic is live. People seem to be able to hear me on this, the way we're set up right now. Thus begins the live broadcast. Plus, we had dead air. Nothing going out at all, and I have no idea why that was the case or how long that was the case. So this is indeed the beginning of the broadcast day for Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, and hopefully broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. And I think that met the test. Okay. Again, my sincere apologies for starting the day so late. I need to remember that there is no buffer of time to deal with technical emergencies like this. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Wren Tawil, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American here in Santa Cruz County on the left coast of North America. I am beginning a new book reading here. The book is entitled Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories by Anna Balzer. This was published in 2007, some 8 years ago. It is updated and revised. Now, so strange working on lines here that I'm not familiar with. Here's the situation once again. I actually began reading this last Saturday, and the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines is the book reading edition of this semi-weekly show. The other edition of Mideast Migraines is every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when I generally take calls, your phone calls, throughout the program. But I'm asking people not to call in until we have an appropriate mid-program break. This program does go until about 1 o'clock. I may go over some 18-20 minutes in order to make up for the lost time. It depends on whether or not the 1 o'clock guy decides to show up at 1. We'll see. And as I began to say, I began reading Witness in Palestine last Saturday, but there was a technical faux pas which terminated the recording of the program. I do not understand why that occurred, but it's just as well, because I wanted to get announcements out to a couple of lists, e-lists, about the reading of this very vivid book, again by Anna Balzer. So I put the announcements out, and here I am disappointing people terribly. We're a good 20 minutes into the program now. So let's get right to it. Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Updated and revised. Copyright 2007. I'll begin with the introduction. And I will say up front, folks, this book has some very vivid descriptions of the author's experiences in the occupied territories of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Very vivid. It certainly will not be easy for many of you to listen to, as it was not a lot of fun for me to read as I began reading this a short time ago. So let's get into it now. One more very brief introduction. Oh, I may as well get into the full kahuna, whatever you want to call it. The archives for this program, Mideast Migraines, which comes to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, are located at two alternate websites, radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the digital number for ALL.NET, radioforall.net, radioforall.net. Go there, load up Mideast Migraines in the search box, and you'll find my most recent programs, roughly the youngest ones starting at the top. Also, you may find yourself at Santa Cruz Media Center Indy Bay. Now, Santa Cruz is two words, of course, S-A-N-T-A. Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z. Media Center Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Santa Cruz Indy Bay.org. You'll also find my most recent programs there, so you can catch up with the readings of previous books. We now have four of them under my belt here. This is number five since November of 2013. I've been doing the Saturday show readings. You may also communicate with me through this program's email address at which is MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness@gmx.com. And we'll be right back, folks.
سيف الغرام قسم قلبي والغير ما درالي لا طبيب فاتني ولا طلبة دبروا عليا مشيت للفقيه نعيد له كل ما جرالي قال لي عشق الريم هذاك علاش جيت ليا
كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي واش هو
circumventions we have and technicalities here, there are also certain advancements. We have a brand new on-air sign, and for the first time I see it hanging in the office here, so I had to go erect the on-air sign. Let us begin. Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Introduction. written by Anna Balzer. Israel has always been a presence in my life. When I was young, my grandmother, who had fled Europe and lost most of her family in the Nazi Holocaust, used to talk about Israel as the one protection that our family and Jews everywhere had against persecution or murder in the future. When I first visited Israel myself, sponsored by a program called Birthright Israel that sends young non-Israeli Jews on a 10-day, all-expenses-paid tour of the Holy Land, I saw nothing to make me think that Israel was anything other than a peace-seeking democracy. My image of Israel was of a tiny, victimized country that simply wanted to live in peace but couldn't because of its aggressive, Jew-hating Arab neighbors. I came to question my view of Israel during a trip through the Middle East. At the time, I was teaching English at a university in Ankara, Turkey, on a Fulbright grant. During vacations, I traveled around Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. I was welcomed everywhere I went, particularly in southern Lebanon, where I was taken in by several families of Palestinian refugees. Mind you, listener, that this is an American Jewish author who is writing here and speaking here. Continuing, one family in particular not only showered me with hospitality and warmth, but accepted and respected me to an extent that I had rarely experienced, even in my own communities back home. Through my friendship with the eldest son, Mahmoud, and his parents, siblings, and neighbors, I began to hear a different narrative about the state of Israel from the one I had heard growing up as a Jewish American. My new friends told me stories of past and present military attacks, house demolitions, land confiscation, imprisonment without trial, torture, and government-sponsored assassination. It seems that these aggressive actions were not carried out for the protection of the Jewish people, as I had previously been taught, but rather for the creation and expansion of a Jewish state at the expense of the rights, lives, and dignity of the non-Jewish people living in the region. It was hard for me to believe that Israel could act so unjustly. Questioning Israel in any way felt like a betrayal of my grandmother. Nonetheless, it became important for me to arrive at my own understanding of the conflict through research and personal witnessing. I read books written from different perspectives and attended presentations by local activists reporting on their experiences in the occupied Palestinian territories, one place where my Birthright Israel tour bus had not stopped. To my disappointment, I began to see that Mahmoud and his family had been right. There was far more to Israel's past and present policies than I had been told. After extensive reading, the following aspects of the current situation in Israel-Palestine became clear to me. Now, of course, the term Israel-Palestine is written Israel/Palestine, as there is still a somewhat nebulous or complete lack of agreement on the part of many on either side of that equation about the way the area should be labeled, whether or not to include one word or the other. It's simply, as it's presented in this book, it is displayed, the term is displayed as Israel/Palestine. After extensive reading, the following aspects of the current situation in Israel-Palestine became clear to me. Here is her list of those aspects. Israel's ongoing occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, is illegal and violates the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as more than 60 United Nations resolutions. Israel has violated more UN resolutions than any other country in the history of the organization. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza and in Israel are denied equal rights to Jews in the same areas purely on the basis of their religion and ethnicity. The Israeli military controls the movement of nearly 4 million Palestinians through a system of checkpoints, roadblocks, and segregated roads. By the same means, Israel also limits the supply of food, water, medical supplies, and other basic necessities to Palestinian civilians. Quick reminder, this book is footnoted at many critical points throughout its length. Onward. The Israeli army and government exercise virtually unchecked freedom to detain, threaten, arrest, imprison, torture, and assassinate Palestinians, often without trial or charge or trial. The Israeli government sponsors the mass transfer of Jewish Israeli citizens from Israel to Jewish-only colonies known as settlements, built illegally on internationally recognized Palestinian land. Israeli settlers suffer practically no legal consequences for building new illegal, according to international and Israeli law, settlements, for expanding existing ones, or for threatening or physically attacking Palestinian civilians. Israel's human rights violations since September of 2000 have left more than four times more Palestinian civilians dead than the total number of Israelis, both civilians and soldiers, killed by Palestinians. The wall, or quote, security fence, end quote, that is currently under construction by Israel, and this was as of first printing in 2007, in the name of preventing terrorism, in fact, weaves through, not around, the West Bank, effectively separating hundreds of thousands of West Bank Palestinians from their land, jobs, hospitals, and schools, and from each other. Israel's policies of occupation and colonization have been consistent with a steady pattern of transferring the indigenous Palestinians out of Israel-Palestine and confiscating their land, water, and resources for Jewish-Israeli use. This process, similar to the ethnic cleansing carried out in North America, Australia, and the former Yugoslavia, began before Israel's creation in May of 1948, and continues today. And finally, every year, the U.S. government funnels billions of American tax dollars to Israel, which are used primarily to purchase American-made weapons to arm the occupying Israeli army and settlers. As an American taxpayer, I feel responsible for the role my money, government, and country play in the violations of international law and human rights. I feel doubly responsible as a Jewish American, since Israel's abuses are being carried out in the name of Jews everywhere. Although I have never been religious, Jewish culture and history have always been a part of my environment, and identifying as a Jew has never seemed so much a choice as a fact. According to prevailing Jewish law and explicit Israeli law, Judaism is based on heritage, not faith or religious practice. I am a member of the community that Israel claims to be protecting through its violations of international law and human rights. In the fall of 2003, I decided to travel to the 1967 occupied Palestinian territories to see the situation for myself. I applied and was accepted to volunteer with the International Women's Peace Service, the IWPS, a grassroots peace organization dedicated to documenting and nonviolently intervening in human rights abuses in the West Bank and supporting the nonviolent movement to end the occupation. This book is a narration of the 8 months that I spent working with IWPS, spanning 5 years. It documents both the situation on the ground, as I observed it, and my personal, emotional, and intellectual journey piecing together my own understanding of the issue. I've tried to describe as accurately as possible what I saw in the West Bank. I do not claim that my presentation of the situation is unbiased. I cannot deny having strong opinions about the issue, which will inevitably be apparent in my narrative. But I have tried to keep my editorializing separate from my reporting. I also do not profess to offer a broad synthesis of the, quote, Arab-Israeli conflict, or even of life in occupied Palestine. As a foreigner voluntarily working on a specific part of the region, for a relatively short period of time, I cannot begin to understand what it means to be a Palestinian living under the occupation. These accounts represent no, quote, side, but my own. They are the observations and recordings of one woman's experience living and working in Palestine. A lot of details in this book are repeated. Dozens of Palestinians detained at checkpoints, threatened by settlers, taunted, and harassed. I have not shied away from these details. It is my belief that to understand the effects of the occupation, one must look not just to the dramatic moments of violence that are represented or misrepresented in the news, but also to the small everyday acts of violence and humiliation, and next to them the small everyday acts of resistance and human dignity. If my accounts feature too many frustrating details of delays, searches, and abuse, I can only say that this is the nature of life under the occupation. This book was primarily intended for Americans and other Westerners who may be uninformed about the current situation in Palestine, but I believe it is suitable for readers everywhere, regardless of their religious beliefs or previous knowledge of the subject. Important words and terms have been highlighted in the text and are defined in the glossary. For those completely unfamiliar with the conflict, I have included a very brief outline of the region's history in Appendix 3. Appendix 4 addresses some of the major questions and myths that surround the issue, and Appendix 5 contains quotations from Israeli, Palestinian, and U.S. leaders, as well as other significant voices articulating what I see as some key points. And obviously, I will delve into at least portions of some of those indices probably after I read the text of the book. This book, by the way, is published by Paradigm Publishers of Boulder, Colorado. You can go to paradigmpublishers.com to find out how you may own a copy or copies of this book. Let us continue with this introduction. Balzer writes, I have divided the volume into parts 1 and 2. Part 1 contains my writings from Palestine between 2003 and 2005, the bulk of this book's first incarnation. Wherever possible, I updated maps and statistics. Part 2 was written during my second stint with IWPS in 2007. Throughout the book, some names were changed for privacy or security. Some quotations were reconstructed from detailed notes, and very minor chronological alterations were made for the sake of coherence. Except for the name changes, all reports are fully accurate to the best of my knowledge, and all errors are my own. Readers may remark a change in my writing between parts 1 and 2. For example, in my earlier writings, I avoided discussing pre-1967 occupation history, both because I had no first-hand experience on the subject and because I saw it as a sore point and a possible deterrent from addressing the urgency of the current situation in the occupied territories. I reasoned that many people who strongly disagreed about the past and future of Israel-Palestine could at least agree that Israel's current policies of occupation and colonization have been a step backward from peace. from the point of view of justice for Palestinians and safety for Israelis. I still believe this to be true. With time, however, I have reoriented my research toward understanding of Zionist history and ideology underlying the entire situation and the plight of the 1948 refugees, as well as Palestinian citizens of Israel, non-Jews living in a Jewish state. I now believe these things to be at the heart of it all, and crucial components of understanding the issue for anyone genuinely seeking a lasting resolution. The afterword, written for this 2014 reprinting on the 10th anniversary of the book's first chapter, outlines extraordinary new developments both inside and outside of the region and their corresponding implications. It also reflects positively and negatively on many of the themes in the book, including nonviolence, Zionism, and the role of Jewish allies and privilege, with the perspective of a decade's work in the movement. This book recounts one piece of a journey that is ongoing. I invite you to join me on that journey through this book and its discoveries, and by continuing to ask tough questions and allowing yourself to be challenged, as I have tried to do. I do not expect or even wish for readers to blindly accept my assertions about Israel and the occupation. I certainly did not believe such claims when I first encountered them. My hope is that readers will react individually to my stories and begin to develop their own understanding of the situation. Readers who do not wish to take my word for it certainly don't have to. There are dozens of Palestinian, Israeli, and international groups organizing tours in Israel-Palestine and documenting all aspects of the situation. Many of these organizations are highlighted in the text and listed in Appendices 1 and 2. What You Can Do and the Resource Guide. These appendices also provide suggestions for further research on the subject, as well as various ways to get involved in the exciting, growing international movement for a just peace in Israel-Palestine. That is Balzer's introduction to the book. Dedication to Mahmoud and his family for reminding me to seek the truth. To Daniel for reminding me to write. And to Andrea for reminding me to believe. Beginning the book, Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories, 2007, updated and revised by Anna Balzer, Part 1, 2003 to 2005. Witness in Palestine, The Olive Harvest, Tuesday, November 18, 2003. My first week in Palestine has been spent in the trees. Every morning I wake up at sunrise to walk with farmers to their olive groves, where we climb the ancient trees and fill our shirts with olives, taking occasional breaks to sip fresh sage tea and admire the scenery. It is fall, November 2003, the time of the olive harvest, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinian olive trees burst with ripe purple olives to be plucked and marinated or pressed for fresh olive oil. For many generations, local Palestinian farmers have depended on the fall harvest as a major source of income to support their families. However, many farmers now say they are afraid to approach their trees alone. They have been traumatized by repeated harassment from soldiers and armed settlers from Israel, who for decades have been patrolling Palestinian land to ensure the protection and expansion of Jewish-only settlements. Settlements are towns or communities built by Israel exclusively for Jews on internationally recognized Palestinian land. Israeli settlements are in violation of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits an occupying power from transferring citizens from its own population to the occupied territory, in this case the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. In many languages, like French, the general word for settlement is the same as the word for colony. But in English and Hebrew, a more benign word is used. People living in Israeli settlements are referred to as settlers, not colonizers. And a reminder again, this first printing of the book in 2007... was preceded 2 years prior to that by the dismantling of the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip. But remember, although the book was published in 07, this information is taken from Balzer's notes, as I indicated at the beginning of part one, from 2003 to 2005. And again, 2005 was the dismantling of Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip. Indeed, there is a footnote here. When this book went to press, Israeli settlers had been evacuated from the Gaza Strip, although the territory remained under Israeli military siege. For a post-evacuation update and analysis, see page 327. Let us continue. In spite of international law, Israel not only condones the illegal settlements, but actively supports their establishment and growth. For example, the Israeli government subsidizes housing, water, electricity, transportation, and many other services for settlers. By declaring settlements, quote, national priority areas, the illegal colonies are entitled to 65% more grants than local councils in Israel. The Israeli government provides individual settlers with financial assistance by enabling them to lease land at rates well below the actual value. That information from Occupation in Hebron, Alternative Information Center, AIC 2004. Israel also offers tax breaks, business incentives, free schooling, and mortgage grants up to 95% in the settlements. To attract new Jewish citizens to become part of the occupying presence. The larger the Israeli population in the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, the stronger Israel's claim to that land becomes. On an Israeli road outside of Ariel Settlement near our house, a Hebrew billboard announces to passersby, "Now is the time to move to Ariel. Join our community and you will receive 100,000 new Israeli shekels." That's more than $20,000 U.S. Advertisements like this appeal not to well-off Israelis, but rather to poorer Israelis, like young families, recent immigrants, or Israelis of color. These might be people who couldn't care less about the political or religious significance of the land itself. Maybe they are simply looking for a higher standard of living for themselves and their families. In fact, most Israeli settlers move to the Palestinian territories not because they think, and I quote, "this land is ours and nobody else's," but because, in one way or another, their government is paying them to do so with American tax dollars. And she notes here, for a comprehensive and interactive map of West Bank settlements, visit peacenow.org/map.php. I will not continue to read every last footnote for this book. I would prefer to read it as a continuous storyline. It is a book to be read by the reader or heard by the listener with some convenience, but if I deem a footnote important enough, I will read it. Again, reading from Anna Balcher's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. It's 11:53 a.m. A minority of settlers chose to live. A minority of settlers choose to live in the Palestinian territories for political or religious reasons. Many of these, quote, ideological, as opposed to, quote, economic settlers, frequently threaten or attack Palestinian farmers and families because they believe the Palestinians are occupying land promised to the Jewish people by God. Due to the increasing danger of settler attacks, many farmers have started requesting accompaniment from Israeli peace groups and international organizations. The hope is that violent settlers or soldiers might exercise restraint in the presence of Israelis or internationals, either out of shame or because we might document the violence and transmit the news to Western media sources, where stories of Israeli settler or soldier violence often go untold. One organization providing international accompaniment to Palestinian farmers is the International Women's Peace Service, the aforementioned IWPS, where I, Anna Balcer, am volunteering for the next 2 months. IWPS is a grassroots peace organization dedicated to documenting and nonviolently intervening in human rights abuses in the West Bank and to supporting Palestinian-led nonviolent resistance to the occupation. We are based in Haris, H-A-R-I-S, an English transliteration, Haris, a small village in the West Bank's rural Salfit region. When farmers from the neighboring village of Deir Istia contacted us recently to request accompaniment, three IWPS women, myself included, and five Israeli activists volunteered to go. Although the Deir Istia farmers' groves are not far from their homes, it was a long walk because Palestinians are not permitted to use the main road connecting their village with their land. That main road is a settler highway built to connect nearby settlements with one another and with Israel proper. Most roads in the occupied territories are segregated, with older, sometimes dirt roads for West Bank Palestinians and modern highways of up to four lanes for Israeli settlers living in the West Bank. The latter are built over demolished homes, olive groves, and old roads of local Palestinian villages, but the road signs often give no indication of past or present Palestinian communities. Signs point the way to Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and nearby Israeli settlements. The ones we passed on the way to Deir Istia's olive groves were printed in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. But the Arabic had been blacked out with spray paint, we assumed, by ideological settlers. Let me pause here to point out, as I did when I attempted to begin the reading of this book last week, that this book by Anna Balcher, Witness in Palestine, is utterly and profusely illustrated not only with gorgeous color photographs, but extremely detailed and roughly current situations reflecting the current demography in Israel and Palestine, including the occupied territories. And when I first looked at the book, frankly, it made me wonder whether or not it would be appropriate to read this on air, since the amount of illustrations, maps, etc., and other somewhat interactive features, might make the reading of the text only rather stale. But I'm changing my mind. I believe this is a perfectly good book to read on this Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. And in fact, I'll point out that there is indeed a color photograph with written captions of a sort pointing to a modern Israeli highway, an overpass. It appears to be at least two lanes in each direction. That's the Israeli road. Underneath a less developed, and I can't tell if it's even paved or not, Palestinian road. To me, that one picture alone reeks of the apartheid nature of Israel. Okay, that is the end for the moment of my editorializing. Continuing with the book. Our first days of harvesting with the farmers and Israeli activists were peaceful. I marveled at the technique of separating olives from leaves. Everything is poured out of buckets from a high place, and the wind carries away the light leaves, while the olives, heavy with oil, fall into a pile together. The atmosphere was pleasant, sorting olives, drinking tea, and chatting in the shade of the silvery trees. The Palestinians did their best in Hebrew, and the Israelis and I tried to speak a little Arabic. Today was less serene. As we moved west with the harvest, we came closer to the bulldozers plowing through Deir Astia's groves. Bulldozers are leveling olive groves for the expansion of nearby Revava settlement. My friends from Deir Astia fear their land will be next. While we are harvesting, a Revava settler with an M16 semi-automatic weapon approached us and asked the Palestinians for their identification papers. The farmers obliged. The other two IWPS women and I approached the settler to observe him, trying to be conspicuous but not threatening. We knew the settler had no right to ask the farmer for his ID. It is a Palestinian grove. But our policy is not to take the lead, rather to support Palestinians in their tactics as long as they are nonviolent. The farmer asked us to stay back. The farmer asked us to stay back, and we did. The farmer knew it was easier and safer to comply rather than refuse and risk facing violence from settlers or soldiers. After the settler left, I volunteered to keep an eye out for settlers or soldiers, and also to keep watch over the farmers' donkeys. I had heard of recent cases of settlers stealing donkeys. Half an hour later, three armed soldiers approached us, and one asked in English if we had seen anyone around. We told him we'd seen a man with a gun. Alarmed, the soldier asked us to describe the man. We described the settler we had just seen, and he relaxed visibly. Quote, "Just a Jew? Oh, his gun is necessary. He has to defend himself." The soldiers asked how long we would be there, and we said until sunset. When they were gone, we discussed the encounter and agreed that in the future we would translate questions into Arabic instead of answering them ourselves, even if the questions were simple. Our purpose is not to speak or fight with Palestinians, but to support their right both to be on their land and to resist the forces occupying it. It was a long walk home after harvesting. In addition to taking a long detour around the settler road, we had to cart all of the olives from that day in one trip because there have apparently been recent incidents of settlers stealing olives in the area. When we arrived at our house in Haris, we learned that a farmer from a nearby village had been taken away by soldiers while he was picking olives with his family and three international volunteers who were accompanying them. Fortunately, several groups were notified and took action. Rabbis for Human Rights, RHR, an Israeli organization that fights human rights violations in Israel and the occupied territories in the Jewish tradition of Tikkun Olam, or social action, is already working on getting the farmer released. CNN reporters who happened to be in the neighborhood at the time will probably have a story too. We are optimistic because of the international media coverage and sympathetic Israeli presence, and some of us will go to the village tomorrow to help finish the harvest that was interrupted. New, I guess I'll call these chapters. They are headlined when the there's a change in scenario or emphasis here. Farmer kidnapped in Marta. Wednesday, November 19, 2003. Which, of course, is the day after all the preceding events I read about to you. Farmer kidnapped in Marta. Today was another long day. We began picking olives early and then received a call that a Palestinian farmer named Ismail was being denied access through Ariel settlement to his land. Ariel is home to about 20,000 settlers and is expanding. Many farmers like Ismail have been separated from their land by the settlement. Ismail has 500 trees full of olives that will go bad unless they are picked in the next few weeks. But he was told he must go the long way around, that is, hike 2 hours around the settlement and several hills to reach land that is only about 10 minutes away from his house, or not go at all. Ismail has an Israeli permit to go to his land in Ariel and has successfully traveled through the checkpoint in the past. But these days, his permit isn't enough. This morning, as Ismail struggled towards the settlement gate on his donkey cart, some settlers in traffic taunted him, saying, "Do you take your donkey cart to Jerusalem also?" The settlers know very well that Ismail, like most Palestinians living in the West Bank, cannot go to Jerusalem. Whereas all Jews in the world can not only visit, but even obtain immediate residency there, in Jerusalem, if they wanted to. Rabbi Arik Asherman from PHR came to help us lobby for Ismail's passage, but with no luck. Next week, Ismail will apply for another permit, the same as the first, to try again to reach his olive trees before it is too late. After saying goodbye to Ismail, Rabbi Asherman and I drove to Marta, where a farmer was taken away by soldiers yesterday afternoon. We were greeted by Chloe and Aldo, two international volunteers whom I recognized from a nonviolence training workshop we attended together in Bethlehem, my first weekend. The workshop was conducted by the International Solidarity Movement, the ISM, a Palestinian-led grassroots organization that enlists international volunteers to support nonviolent Palestinian resistance to the occupation. At the training, we practiced quick consensus-based decision-making in emergency situations, as well as nonviolent direct action, physical action to restrain an oppressive force. Chloe and Aldo work with ISM, and yesterday they witnessed the abduction in Marta. They said three soldiers approached their group of olive pickers, and one soldier motioned to Amid, a farmer, to get into their jeep. Amid was very frightened and did as the soldier said. When Chloe and Aldo asked the soldier what he was doing, he replied sarcastically, "I am just a maniac." Chloe called the ISM office and took out her camera, but the soldier threatened her, so she put it away. The soldier drove away with Amid for 5 minutes and then returned with a bulldozer, saying he would come back that night to bulldoze all the family's trees. Tamir, The owner of the trees was terrified. Chloe and Aldo agreed to stay with Amid's wife and children that night to show their support and to check on the trees from time to time. An hour later, Rabbi Asherman and about 50 RHR volunteers showed up to help finish picking the olives. Chloe said they carpeted the land, and within half an hour, the entire harvest was finished. Chloe's eyes lit up when she described the image of 50 Israeli activists coming to the aid of Amid's and Tamir's families. She also related something Tamir had said to the soldier who returned with the bulldozer. "Look at the way my children are looking at you. We are supposed to be negotiating peace, but imagine how you must appear in their eyes," she said. She was heartened that the children's last impression of Israelis that day had been a positive one. According to Chloe, 7 hours or so after being taken away, Amid returned home. His clothes were dirty, his hair matted, and he looked startled. He said the soldiers had forced him to lie down in the back of the jeep to avoid being seen as they drove. They took him to an abandoned building, blindfolded him, tied rags around his limbs to prevent bruising, and then beat him. Amid, who speaks fluent Hebrew from his years working in Israel, pleaded with the soldiers, asking what he had done wrong. The lead soldier replied, "I'm not doing this because you've done anything wrong. I'm doing this because you're Palestinian and I want you dead." The lead soldier then took off Amit's blindfold and pointed a gun at his face, telling him to, quote, "prepare to die." At the last minute, another soldier reminded his colleague that one of the international volunteers had perhaps gotten a photograph of them. The lead soldier got scared and let Amid go. "When I met Amid, he looked exhausted, but was friendly and welcomed me into his home. Rabbi Asherman began to talk to Amid about his rights to file a complaint about the abuse. Chloe had taken down the license plate number of the jeep when it first drove away, which will hopefully be enough to track the soldiers. It is not clear that the offending soldier will face charges for his crime, since the victim was Palestinian. Generally, soldiers are only reprimanded for violence against Jews or, sometimes, internationals. During my time with Rabbi Asherman, we talked about Israeli culture and how it is changing. When I traveled to Israel last year, anticipating the warm Jewish culture to which I was accustomed, I was shocked and upset by the ubiquitous suspicion, soldiers, and guns that made me feel far more uneasy than secure. Rabbi Asherman lamented the deterioration of values that he had originally sought in Israel. He is from the United States. He said he also believes there is a current movement of Jewish Israelis to, quote, return to themselves, to return to what he considers the, quote, strong, passionate Jewish morality, fundamental in the Jewish culture and religion. Israeli former soldiers who, like Rabbi Asherman, and I quote, feel that service in the occupied territories and the incidents Israeli soldiers have faced have distorted and harmed the moral values on which they grew up, end quote, have formed a group called Breaking the Silence. Hundreds of regretful Israeli ex-soldiers have come forward to, and I quote, tell the truth about everything that goes on in the occupied territories each and every day. According to former soldiers' investigations and testimonies, incidents of abuse and army brutality like the kidnapping in Marta are no longer the exception. They have become the norm. From what Amid could tell, the two other soldiers involved in the incident disapproved of the actions of their commanding officer, but were too intimidated to stop him. During my time here, I hope to see more soldiers listen to their consciences instead of blindly following their superiors. I know that members of Breaking the Silence wish they had done so. I am personally encouraged by the recent evidence that, as in Amid's case, an international presence can make a difference. And a very nice color picture here of an Israeli activist, Yehoshua Rosen, picks olives in solidarity with Abu Faud, a Palestinian farmer from Deir Hestia. It's 13 minutes past 12 noon here in Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California, 12:13 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on this February 21 edition of Mideast Migraine. The Saturday edition, the book reading edition. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org and broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz at 101.3 on the FM dial. I will now take phone calls during this short intermission. Not too short. It will allow me to have some breakfast. Both lines 1 and 2 are area code 831. That's 831 in Santa Cruz County, California. Line 1 is 427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. Area code 831, 469-3119. Please call in. I will take your call immediately. You will not go on the air right away until you express that you would like to go on air. The lines are open. كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرق في معصر بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرق في معصر بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرق في معصر بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرق في معصر بيا كيفاش قلتي يا ناسي وش هو عملي واللي نعيد له يستغرق في معصر بيا.
صحباتي وما عنديش تقاشر كانوا غير هذوك اللي بقاولي والآن حبيت نحبط في سنتر فيل ونسي كاش ما يحبس لي كاش تاكسي نربط في صباني وما عنديش تقاشر طحروا لي كي تحت في الغرقة كانوا غير هذوك اللي بقاولي ودركت غير الفرق في جيبي والآن حبيت نحبط في صدر ميل ونسي كاش ما يحبس لي كاش تاكسي آيا خوش محلي ولا غير كومبلي ودركت غير الفرق في جيبي يا كل نمشي ابي كيما العاده في العاصمه رجلي لي بابي ما عطاوليش لو فيزا مون اوري في البلاد بصح كل يوم غير الفرق في جيبي وجعت كرشي وراني جيعان كل شي غالي في هاد البلاد سي دوماج هاد لا بروباغوند مي سي فري غير الفرق في جيبي بابا لا 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 لا
call in here to the Midi's Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, area code 831 for both lines. Line 1 is 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. About 5 more minutes for you to call in and discuss, observe, etc. Putumayo presents Arabic Beat. Putumayo World Music. That last piece of music, and counting backwards, track 4, Jalal El Hamdoui by Sidi Habibi, Moroccan and Belgian influences. Before that, you heard Noor by Narbat, influences from Spain, Algeria, France, and Morocco. Preceded by Ali Slimani by Lyra, a remix. Algerian UK fusion influences. And before that, I believe we were listening to track 1 there. Jamel Larousi by Kifak Hilti, Algeria, Germany. Earlier in the program, you were listening to, I think it was Zain Al-Jundi by Ajmal Karam, Syria, and Hubin by Rai Metelfni, Algeria and France. Influences there. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, the Saturday book reading edition for Saturday, February 21, 2015. The ringers are off. You had your chance to call me on this, the Mideast Migraine Show, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live and free, as always, at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. If you're listening to the radio now, just remember, if you ever want to listen online, go to our main page at www.freakradio.org and follow the instructions. Click on the listen link to discover how you too can listen online. Tell everyone, your friends, family, your enemies, about this program. Let's keep the discussion going. Don't forget, you may also contact me through this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Mideast Madness is the former name of the program. It is now Mideast Migraines on FRSC. Eventually, this program, I expect to have put up on the archives, located at 2 other websites, radioforall.net, radio the number 4, all.net, radioforall.net, and of course, Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay, Indybay, Santa Cruz, Indy Bay, also where the archives are. Back to the book, folks. And it's 12:30 p.m. Again, the book is entitled Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories, 2007. Although the details in this first chapter cover the author's experiences from 2003 to 2005. The book is updated and revised just last year. The author is Anna Balzer, the Jewish-American woman in the territories. Back to it now. Checkpoint watch at Deir Balut and Jubara. Thursday, November 20, 2003. This morning I went on my first checkpoint watch. Checkpoints are barriers manned by soldiers or border police to restrict pedestrian and vehicular mobility. Unlike border crossings, most checkpoints in the occupied Palestinian territories are installed within the West Bank and Gaza, not around them. Which is to say, not necessarily between the West Bank and Israel, or exactly between Gaza and Israel, right on the border there. Continuing, the Israeli government claims checkpoints are necessary to prevent Palestinian attacks on Israelis, but checkpoints primarily restrict movement between Palestinian cities and villages, not between the occupied territories and Israel. Abuses by Israeli soldiers or police are so common at checkpoints checkpoints that Israeli and international volunteers have developed Checkpoint Watch to witness those abuses and, if possible, intervene to stop them. Today we observe the checkpoint that monitors movement into and out of Deir Balut, a small village just east of the Green Line, the internationally recognized border between Israel and the West Bank. Last night, the army unexpectedly closed the checkpoint into Deir Balut, and several villagers were stranded away from home. When we arrived in the early morning, the checkpoint was almost empty, save for a few children on their way to school. In the old days, the students used to take a school bus, but the vehicle obstructions have rendered that option more hassle than it's worth. Instead, the children and teachers walk past snipers and electric fences on their way to class every morning, showing their IDs and opening up their book bags to be searched. Since checkpoint wait times are always unpredictable, so are the school hours. Three teachers came to the checkpoint after we arrived, and the soldier motioned for them to come up one by one. The first woman approached the soldier, waited while he searched her, and then continued when he nodded that she could pass. The next two women had brought their school identification, but not their Israeli-issued identity papers. Apparently, school IDs had been enough in the past, but today's soldier said that wouldn't suffice. The women tried to explain to the soldier that if they went all the way back to their village to fetch their papers, they would be late for their classes. In the end, they went all the way back home and were late for their classes. I asked the soldier if he was worried that the women were dangerous. He said it was against the rules to let them pass without papers. I took a step forward and asked him if he ever thought about the rules he was enforcing. He shouted at me to step back. I held my ground and said I just wanted to talk, but he barked at me to go back right away. I turned and walked back to the concrete blocks where my colleagues were observing. I felt terrible about the exchange. It seemed my questions had made him angrier, and I knew he would not be the one to suffer the consequences of my actions and his bad mood. In everything internationals do, our first consideration must always be the effects our actions will have on the people around us, both long-term and short-term. I believe the questions I asked the soldier were good ones, but it may have been a mistake to ask them at that moment. I may be able to leave when things become heated, but most people here cannot. At 9 a.m. we left Deir Balut for the city of Tulkarim to visit two women who were setting up a cooperative for local seamstresses. One woman asked me if I would help her sell locally produced handicrafts abroad. I said I would inquire about possibilities, but I am not optimistic. Most Palestinian trade is restricted to countries maintaining good diplomatic relations with Israel, which excludes many neighboring Arab countries. Palestine trade is also subject to Israeli taxes, which are sometimes higher than Palestinian merchants can afford to pay. Both women work full-time teaching local female villagers about democracy, leadership, and communication. The women told us familiar stories of farmers denied access to their land at checkpoints or allowed through their denied permission to return for up to a week, by which time their freshly picked crops had gone bad and could no longer be sold. Poor families are getting poorer, and many parents can no longer afford to send their children to school. It costs about 45 shekels, U.S. $10 a year, for a Palestinian child to attend school. The women implored us to raise money to help the children, many of them young girls whose education is not a priority in some traditional families. We visited a school on the edge of Tul Karam near an Israeli military training camp. The headmaster reported that soldiers frequently taunt the children playing in the yard during recess. He said that the army once bombed the school from military planes. He wondered how anyone could expect the children to learn to read and write when they are worried about being bombed. We left Tul Karam via the city's southern checkpoint, Jubara, which was in chaos. The soldiers were keeping people back by placing a rubber rod on the ground and threatening anyone who crossed it. We felt trapped behind this imaginary wall as the soldiers walked back and forth in front of us with large guns. Of course, the barrier applied only to Palestinians. When the soldiers saw our group of internationals, they waved us through even without looking at our passports. We were not the only privileged people there. Cars with yellow license plates drove straight through the checkpoint without stopping. Israelis and Palestinians have different colored license plates, so soldiers can easily identify whether a car is carrying Israelis or Palestinians. Israeli plates are yellow, while Palestinian plates are white and green. At Jubara checkpoint, as at others, yellow-plated cars are allowed to pass unhindered, while white-plated and green-plated cars, ambulances included, stood waiting for hours at gunpoint. And let me hearken back for a moment to what Anna Balzer here, the author of the book, said a couple of pages ago, that most of the checkpoints, the kind that she spoke of right now, are checkpoints within occupied Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza back then, and East Jerusalem, all illegally militarily occupied by Israel. The checkpoints are intra-passage within the territories, not between the territories and Israel, or, say, not between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, which says a lot about the supposed security aspect for Israelis in terms of the efficacy of what the Israelis and border police are doing. Okay, let's continue now. I began to feel sick. I hadn't eaten in hours because it is impolite to eat in public during Ramadan, the month-long Islamic holiday of fasting that began a few weeks ago. As I grew hungrier, I stopped taking in what I was seeing. It was too disturbing, and I couldn't think about it anymore. I sat down on the curb and shoved a few bites of food into my mouth. When I emerged from my hunger-induced daze, the scene in front of me came back into focus. I watched the Palestinians standing squeezed together like cattle in the hot sun, knowing most of them had been fasting since 4 a.m. I had only been without food since 10. I wondered where they had practiced such patience. I wondered how I would react in their shoes. If I were a Palestinian, would I resist? Would I stand up for myself? Yes, probably. And then I would be kicked down. And down again until I had no more spirit. Or maybe my spirit would grow stronger with every kick. Oppression affects people differently. Some grow more and more determined. Others grow hopeless. Perhaps some have the lucidity to think rationally about the situation. Then again, attempting to think rationally and practically in the context of such inhumanity would probably drive most sane people crazy. New chapter, The Wall, Munira's House, and Other Families in the Seam. Friday, November 21, 2003. Today I visited a warm and soft-spoken woman named Munira, who lives with her husband, Hani, and their six small children on the outskirts of Mas'hat village. Hani and his family came to Mas'hat as refugees from the war of 1948, known to Palestinians as the Nakba, or catastrophe, because it marked the exodus of three quarters of Palestine's native population, who have never been allowed to return. Hani's father was killed in the war. Left without a breadwinner, the young Hani and his family were homeless for 10 years. When Hani grew up, he built a home for himself and his family in Mas'hat. He and Munira built nurseries and greenhouses and lived off their trees, land, and animals. Even when the nearby Ilkana settlement was founded in 1978 and grew to within 20 feet of their bedroom window, the family did not move. Then, last year, another Nakba of Palestinian recent history began, the building of Israel's separation barrier, the wall. And I note here that this is the wall also referred to as the apartheid wall, named after the expression of separating races, ethnicities, and classes as it was practiced in South Africa during their apartheid era. Continuing with Balzer's book now. If you were to build a wall to prevent two groups from hurting one another, where would you build it? Most people would build on the border between the two peoples. In fact, that is where most supporters of Israel's wall believe it to be. Again, in fact, that is where most supporters of Israel's wall believe it to be, the wall, between Israel and the West Bank. But any map of the planned and partially completed path of the wall, a map that you're unlikely to find in any mainstream U.S. newspaper, even though Americans are the ones paying for it, reveals a different reality. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Human Affairs, OCHA, the western half of the wall is expected to annex approximately 14.5% of West Bank land to Israel, a percentage OCHA estimates will at least double after completion of the projected extensions and closures on the eastern side. The barrier winds deeply into the West Bank, passing close by Palestinian built-up areas and annexing the surrounding land and water sources to Israel. Along with existing settlements. Although Israeli settlements have only built up about 3% of the West Bank, with the surrounding land and water sources, they control about 40%. Situated on the outskirts of Mas'hat, Munira and Hani's house posed a problem for the Israeli army, who implored the family to move so that the wall could annex the house and neighboring area to Ilkana. Munira and Hani refused. They also refused financial compensation, insisting that all they wanted was to remain in their home, to live and work on their land in peace. The army responded by building a 25-foot concrete wall in front of Munira's house, separating the family from their land, village, and community. The wall continues in both directions, leaving Munira's family on the Israeli side of the fence, even though they are on internationally recognized Palestinian territory, well east of the Green Line. In Munira's backyard is another fence keeping the family out of neighboring Ilkana, which, like all settlements, is reserved for Jews only. There are fences on the remaining two sides of Munira's house. Surrounded on all four sides, Munira and her family live in a cage, an open-air prison. M- Munira and Hani are determined to stay in their home as long as they can, but the obstacles increase every day. Because of the wall, Hani can no longer easily reach his work in nearby Azun Atma, and Munira can hardly leave her house for fear of it being destroyed. To reach the remaining land, Munira and Hani have to wait hours for soldiers to unlock the gate of the cage. Hani says the army initially wasn't going to build a gate, but they agreed to after the Red Cross, United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and various Israeli human rights groups interfered. Munira and Hani say they feel like foreigners on their own land. Their youngest children, on the other hand, have grown accustomed to their cage, having forgotten what life was like before the wall. The parents worry about the children's isolation from other children and the long-term social, economic, educational, and psychological effects that the two Nakbas will have on future generations. Friends, family, IWPS, and delegations try to visit Munira often, but we're dependent on soldier schedules, and delegations try to visit. Friends, family, IWPS, and delegations try to visit Munira often, but we're dependent on soldier schedules and whims. During Ramadan, the gate to Munira's cage has been open just once a day, from 4 to 5 in the afternoon. It is well known that this hour is reserved for cooking and the breaking of the fast, and is not a time when people can visit, particularly not women. IWPS inquired about the reasoning behind the schedule, but the army did not respond. The intention, however, seems clear: to render life so difficult that the family surrenders and leaves, quote, voluntarily. Munira is just one of more than 31,000 West Bank Palestinians who have been completely encircled by the wall. 31,000. Hundreds of thousands have been separated from their jobs, schools, and hospitals. In fact, 80% of the wall doesn't even touch the internationally recognized border, leaving approximately 375,000 Palestinians stranded in the, quote, seam, the area between the wall and the Green Line. Like all Palestinians in the occupied territories, residents of the seam don't have the rights afforded to Israeli citizens, but they are required to pay taxes to Israel. Furthermore, families in the seam are required to obtain permits to continue living in their own homes on their own land. Jewish Israelis, on the other hand, are free to move into the seam without permits. In fact, I could move there next month if I wanted to, because I'm Jewish. Munira's is not the only family that is resisting. In an act of civil disobedience, many families in Jabara village in El Tul Karim have been refusing to carry Israeli permits, which are difficult to acquire and expire after 3 months. The families are worried that if they accept the premise that Palestinians should need Israeli permits to continue living on their own land in the seam, the government will eventually revoke them as a means of forcing the families out. As punishment for refusing to obtain permits, the people of Jubara have been kept under Israeli military curfew, during which residents are forbidden to leave their homes for any reason at any time except a few hours a week to get food. The curfew has prevented any residents from leaving their village for the past month. One week ago, we went to Jabara to visit Azmi, a man whose house has been separated from his village by the wall. Every day, military jeeps drive through his backyard on their patrol of the wall. and the army has informed him that his house is under demolition order. Instead of leaving, Azmi and his family have found their own unique method of resistance. They are building a new house right next to the old one, so that when their first house is destroyed, they can move into the second, buying themselves more time, assuming the military waits for a second demolition order. On the way to Azmi's house, we met another family separated from their village by the wall. The son smiled at us as we walked by, and eventually the whole family came out and invited us in for tea. The son was studying at a university in Nablus, but had not been able to go to school recently because of Jubara's checkpoint and curfew. His commute, which used to be half an hour, is now 2 hours each way. His younger sister and brother came out, and we asked if they were in school too. They said they were, but that their school was on the other side of the wall, so sometimes when the gates are closed, they don't make it. The gates are usually open 3 times a day for an hour at a time. If they are closed, it's a 2.5-mile walk to the next gate, and another 2.5 miles to get back down to the village school. The father of the children looked at his land and olive groves with a mixture of pride and sadness. The mother motioned towards the wall with disgust. "Our village, our family, is on the other side of that wall," she exclaimed. "My mother is sick, but I cannot go to her when she needs me. This is what they call peace. Every day they take more, and when we fight back, they take even more. But stolen territory will never bring Israel security, as they suggest. Security will come from peace, and peace will never come from a wall," end quote. Next chapter, Roadblocks and a Demonstration in Budrus. Sunday, November 23. This is back in 2003. Today we attended a demonstration against the wall in Budrus, a Palestinian village near the west the Green Line west of Ramallah. Budrus is not far from where we live, but it took over 2 hours to travel there because we had to change taxis every 15 minutes or so at each roadblock along the way. Roadblocks are concrete blocks or dirt piles installed by the Israeli military to inhibit vehicular movement on Palestinian roads. Roadblocks are not guarded by soldiers and do not prevent people from crossing on foot. Their sole purpose is to complicate or prevent Palestinian movement. Instead of taking their cars on the main road to work, Palestinians must take either indirect unpaved roads or taxis that shuttle back and forth between roadblocks. There is a roadblock at the entrance of Haris, where we live. In order to leave Haris, we had to hike out of the village and catch transportation to the main road. Imagine if to leave your town or city you had to walk to its outskirts. Our landlord owns a car, but to use it he must take an uncomfortable paved detour that has already caused serious damage to the vehicle. Like most structures of the occupation, roadblocks are ostensibly built for Israeli security. Yet I cannot imagine how it helps Israeli citizens to prevent Palestinians from using their own cars and their own roads. More than anything else, roadblocks add stress and struggle to any movement. For instance, a commuter will drive his car every day to a roadblock, obstructing his road to work, park his car at the roadblock, walk across by foot, and then take a taxi the rest of the way. He may end up paying more for taxis than he earns at his job, rendering work a waste of time. Roadblocks allow Israel to maintain a type of control over Palestinians' mobility and daily lives at little cost. Roadblocks also affect the Palestinian economy. Transporting Palestinian products past them is a three-step process. First, the truck carrying goods must back up against the roadblocks. Then another truck must back up to the other side of the roadblock. Finally, somebody has to manually transport the goods from the first truck to the second. By lifting the goods over the roadblocks, the added manpower, vehicles, and gas required to transport Palestinian products often renders them even more costly than their Israeli counterparts, which are quick and easy to transport on the Israeli-only roads. As a result, the Palestinian market is then flooded with Israeli products. Palestinians, many of whom struggle to make ends meet, may end up buying the cheaper Israeli products rather than supporting their own economy, in effect, financing the very country that is occupying them. So Israel actually profits financially from the road obstructions. Because so many passengers and goods are forced to change vehicles at roadblocks, they have become popular gathering places, and it's common to find tea vendors and falafel stands in addition to taxi stations. Seeing business develop from the roadblocks is both inspiring and depressing. It's inspiring to see that Palestinian enterprise and ingenuity continue to spark even in such dismal conditions. But it's depressing to see that what would normally be intolerable burdens have become normal daily life. Physically removing roadblocks has been a common form of resistance during this intifada, Arabic for uprising. But such direct action invariably results in the collective punishment of the Palestinians living in the area of the action. Common punishments include the addition of new military checkpoints, the imposition of curfews, arrests, and home demolitions. On the way to the demonstration today, we passed Kfar Tapua, an Israeli settlement near the Palestinian village of Yasuf. It is easy to distinguish the settlements from Palestinian villages. The former are usually on hilltops for geographical advantage, with large modern houses, often identical. They look like suburban gated communities. Settlements are built rapidly, whereas Palestinian villages have usually evolved organically over time in keeping with the topography of the landscape. Built using materials from the land, they blend naturally into the countryside. Now, folks, it is 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Pacific time, here in Santa Cruz County, California. Normally, the show goes from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pending the possible arrival of the next programmer, whose name and program shall remain unannounced until and if he arrives, I shall go for another 20 minutes of the reading, so I have a full two-hour program to have on file for you at my archives. The archives for the recorded shows of Mideast Migraines are located at radioforall.net, radioforall.net, and Santa Cruz Indy Bay. Santa Cruz Indy Bay. Continuing with Anna Balzer's book. Tapua and the area around the settlement are home to notoriously violent ideological settlers and the army division that protects them. On weekends, settlers sometimes picnic at the natural springs and beautiful gardens of Yasuf with their children, guard dogs, and guns. The next village along our way was Kwarawat Bani Zaid, where a devastatingly beautiful boy knocked on the taxi window and lifted up his shirt, revealing a massive wound that was draining into a sack strapped to his stomach. I didn't know what to do or say, but he smiled at me reassuringly as our taxi began to move. We sped off through the mountains until we arrived in Budrus and joined the locals to head towards the hills where the demonstration was taking place. As we walked, I practiced my rudimentary Arabic, and the children laughed at my name. Anna means me, I, or I am in Arabic. So when I say I'm Anna, it sounds like I'm saying I'm me, or just stuttering. I'm. The goal of the demonstration was to walk to the Budrus land that Israel is leveling for the wall and to document and protest its destruction. As we hiked over the first hill, I made out a mass of people in the valley below. It was a moving sight, hundreds of Palestinians waving flags and children running with banners that glimmered in the sunlight. At the top of the next hill, between us and the threatened land, were the soldiers, standing watch. I hurried to join the crowd below. It scared me to see the soldiers watching over us, and I fumbled with the onion I had brought in my pocket in case we were tear gassed. The strong smell of an onion is supposed to remind you that you are still breathing, countering the gas's tendency to make you believe that you're choking. That's fascinating. I'm going to read that again. It scared me to see the soldiers watching over us, and I fumbled with the onion I had brought in my pocket in case we were tear-gassed. The strong smell of an onion is supposed to remind you that you are still breathing, countering the gas's tendency to make you believe that you were choking. I'll have to keep that in mind. I tried to be as conspicuous as possible, knowing that my purpose was not to blend in, but rather to make my presence known to the soldiers in hopes that it would discourage violence. At the top of the hill, the soldiers looked ready to confront us. The crowd stopped in front of them, and my colleague Jamie and the demonstration organizers stepped forward to talk to the soldiers. The soldiers had no right to be there, but I found them surprisingly self-restrained, given the noisy taunting from the crowd. It's astonishing to see young boys yelling at men holding machine guns. But I suspect I would yell, too, if I were in their shoes. After several fruitless attempts by organizers to explain to the soldiers what the protest was about and why we should pass, the soldiers began to look bored, and a few Palestinian boys started to throw rocks from a nearby hill. The organizers tried to encourage the crowd to disperse. And as we began walking back to the car, my colleague Dunya was hit in the head with a rock. She was bleeding heavily when I reached her, and she said she was hurt and needed to leave. Our group split up. Five women left, and three of us stayed. I was in charge of photographic documentation, so I continued taking pictures while we discussed our next steps with some other international activists and photographers. All of a sudden, and I still don't know why, the entire group of protesters turned and began to race into a field of trees. The soldiers raised their guns and fired several tear gas canisters and rubber bullets into the air. The shots were clearly over the heads of our group of internationals and landed somewhere in the trees where Palestinians were crouched. We quickly decided to leave since our presence was obviously not improving matters. When we left, the soldiers were still firing into the trees. We were frustrated by the escalation of events and planned to discuss the incident at our next team meeting when Jamie and Dunya returned from the hospital. It is very hard to know what risks to take in such situations and how much good we can really do. It seems to vary from day to day, soldier to soldier. The demonstrators who drove us home today made it clear that they appreciated our presence immensely. One boy, with scars on his lower abdomen and lower back where a bullet went in and out 6 months ago, asked me where I was from, and I told him I was Jewish American. He looked surprised, and I told him, yes, I was Jewish, but that I supported Palestinians' right to their land and self-determination. He gave me a big smile and put out his hand for me to shake, which I did. He said I was very welcome in Palestine. It's 107. This chapter, entitled Janine Camp, Monday, November 24. Today we went north to visit Janine City and refugee camp. Janine City has a different feel from other cities I visited in Palestine. It feels somehow wounded. While the people are not unfriendly, many are suspicious after what they have experienced. We visited the ISM apartment in Janine and to look at pictures for an exhibition they were preparing. The pictures, drawn by 12-year-old Palestinian children given a free drawing task, were of tanks and soldiers cutting down trees and shooting men, women, and children. No drawing was without violence or bloodshed. One picture showed a group of children with backpacks running from a tank. A child had fallen into a ditch behind the rest and was about to be shot. Another picture showed a pregnant woman kneeling on the floor, crying at the sight of her dead and bloodied son. Behind her, a large hole in the wall revealed the tank that had destroyed the house and killed the young man. And indeed, there is a color picture of the child's drawing. Quite very full picture, well detailed drawings by Palestinian children in Janine, given a free drawing task. The tank is at a lower, two tanks are at a lower elevation, actually one tank and one mobile soldier army carrier, apparently. Approaching, a young boy with a backpack, apparently desperate to try to get up a hill to join his friends. And there are soldiers accompanying between the two vehicles, pointing their handheld machine guns at him. Continuing now with the text. Another picture showed two soldiers standing on a tank, pointing guns at two children walking to school. Apparently the same picture I was describing to you. A friend translated the Arabic script for me. One soldier was saying, "You may not go to school," to one of the children, to which one of the children was responding, "We won't go home. We will go to school and we will learn and we will stay here to protect our land in Jerusalem, our capital." At the top right of the page was written, "Despite the siege and handcuffs, we will stay here with our people until we achieve our goal of freedom and independence." Janine has a reputation for fighting back. Locals say that in April of 2002, it took 12,000 Israeli troops 8 days to capture one small section of the city because so many people fought to the death. Many residents have shown that they would rather die than surrender their homes and lives to military control. Nonetheless, Janine is now effectively imprisoned by the wall, which separates the city from its land and nearby villages. Most of the fertile soil for which Janine is famous is now inaccessible. The three Palestinian villages in the seam on the other side of the wall are under constant pressure from the Israeli government to move. Israel frequently cuts their water and electricity off. Two 2 weeks ago, Palestinians and international solidarity volunteers succeeded in a direct action of cutting through a fenced section of the wall north of Jenin. 2 days later, it was rebuilt even stronger, but protesters went back last Saturday to show that they would not be deterred. The second protest was successful in that it made the front page of the Israeli mainstream newspaper Haaretz. But it was also tragic in that a young boy was shot and killed by the army in Jenin during ISM's absence. The boy was 12 years old, a fifth grader named Ibrahim. Violence in Jenin is not uncommon. According to locals, Israeli occupation forces shot 7 young Palestinians in a nearby village earlier this month, 2 of whom died. 2 out of 7. They were dressed in their best clothes, making their way home for iftar, the ceremonial breaking of the Ramadan fast. Locals also recounted an incident in which 3 teenage boys were taken into the forest and severely beaten. Let me remind everyone and point out that these were events that happened approximately 2003, some 12 years ago. I say that because we're told here about locals recounting an incident in which 3 teenage boys, Palestinian boys, were taken into the forest and severely beaten. And I hold that revelation up to the recent story which preceded the third Israel attack on the Gaza Strip, that incident being the kidnapping and killing of the 3 Jewish yeshiva students in the West Bank, which is not their land to begin with. Soldiers grabbing and absconding with Palestinian children happens more often than most people would like to admit, and certainly more often than most people are even aware. So to repeat, locals also recounted an incident in which 3 teenage boys were taken into the forest and severely beaten. Apparently, one soldier stuck a gun in a boy's face and said, "At the count of 3, I will shoot you," but another soldier intervened. The boys returned to their homes with bruises all over their bodies. One boy's eye was nearly poked out. They said the soldiers had made them eat grass like animals. The military has maintained a frequent presence in Jenin since the violent spring of 2002. That March, a deadly Palestinian suicide attack on the eve of Passover in the city of Netanyahu killed almost 30 Israelis, allegedly in response to the bombing, but using an offensive planned far in advance, and in parentheses here, in part by studying German tactics and taking over the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, according to one Israeli officer. Israeli soldiers driving American-made bulldozers plowed through the center of Jenin refugee camp, home to 13 impoverished Palestinians, a handful of whom had been putting up armed resistance to the Israeli military takeover. Soldiers bulldozed homes indiscriminately, without regard to whether any civilians were still inside. According to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW, Israel then prevented medical and humanitarian relief workers from entering the camp for more than 10 days while victims perished under the rubble. Thousands of survivors were rendered homeless for the second time in recent history, the first time being in 1948, when they became refugees. I guess I'm going to discontinue the reading now. It's been almost 2 solid hours of Mideast Migraines, the Saturday edition. Bookmark that, those 2 pages. Again, my apologies for the technical difficulties that, frankly, I should have been aware of. I was made privy to them, at least in part, earlier this past week. It was more than simply a matter for those members of the collective who may be listening. It's more than a matter of the volume slider being blocked on our main microphone, but the fact that I can only find one other microphone, one of the tabletop mic stands, and it took me over 5 minutes to determine exactly which pot I had to turn in order to make it work. It appears as though this program has otherwise gone on air without a hitch. And again, folks, this is just a reminder to you of the kind of things that we here at Pirate Underground community-based grassroots radio have to put up with on our shoestring budget and operation. We can always use an infusion of at least one more technically minded individual or expert, people who are willing to help with this operation, and of course, as ever, we look for more programmers from our own local community here in Santa Cruz and its environs who may be willing to produce, broadcast, and host their own show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We ask you to consider making a donation to this end, or to assist in that end if you are not personally inclined to join our family collective of radio producers here on this ongoing act of civil disobedience, being in non-compliance to the Federal Communications Commission. We operate and have operated for 20 years now without a license by the FCC. Please mail your donations and your applications for a program or program idea to this address, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or simply write FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, again two words, S-A-N-T-A, Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, California, zip code 95061. Again, that address is FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. PayPal donations may be made at www.freakradio.org. Please join me next Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific for the continued reading of Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories, by Anna Balzer. 11 a.m. Saturday, and of course, don't forget the other edition of Mideast Migraines, 3 p.m. Monday afternoons, 3 o'clock on Mondays. The entirety of the time during which I will take your phone calls unhindered. And unrestrained by the preferably uninterrupted reading of the books. Again, the book readings take place on the Saturday edition. I bring you other news and interesting items, not to mention some gloriously beautiful Middle Eastern music on the Monday edition. Here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, this is Ren Tawil saying thank you for joining me. And ta-ta.